Once again, this is going to be about how we point ourselves in the correct direction. It's important to continually point this out because it's so easy for the pressures of our culture, our society, people we know, and our habit patterns to turn this effort here, this unique effort, into something less than what it could be. So I'm going to start today in this discussion with a little bit about my experience. You all know that I went to Indonesia and got back about a week ago. And I wanted to mention something that I experienced there and then something that we've all experienced here as a way of pointing out what I just mentioned about the direction we need to go in. So when I first got to Indonesia, it was actually me and 15 other people. We arrived in Bali, in the large city of Denpasar, and then took a van to a smaller city called Ubud, U-B-U-D. And there we spent 3 nights and 2.5 days in an absolutely beautiful place, owned by a millionaire, hand-built out of local woods and hardwoods, ironwood, teak. A stunning place with an infinity pool overlooking a gorge, surrounded by jungle. Beautiful, just beautiful. At the end of the broken-up road, in an average neighborhood, I suppose, of regular folks, regular Balinese folks. This was just our way of getting over the jet lag, and this person who owned the house was actually an acquaintance, a diving friend of someone who set this trip up. So we had the great luck of being in this absolutely beautiful place to recover from the 12 hours of jet lag. So the first morning when I woke up, I decided I was going to take a little walk by myself. I like doing this on these trips with lots of other people in particular because it enables me to experience things more directly without the need to comment, without the need to be distracted by tales of prior trips and plans for future trips. This happened many times during this particular trip, but not this morning. This morning when I got up and went by myself. So I started walking up this hill, broken up street, narrow, crowded with houses, all of which had these beautifully carved, handmade doors that were porticos to kind of an open-roofed common area in the house with many rooms where a family would live. And this family was an extended family. This was like mother, father, brother, sisters, grandchildren, grandparents, cousins, uncles. They tend to live in these large communal group houses. Very humble. Nothing at all fancy. As a matter of fact, on the way in the night before, driving down various roads as we approached this one road that ended in the dead end where this incredible compound was hidden in the woods, I saw people bathing in these open streams right in front of their houses. So on almost every street there it's a very wet place, obviously, Indonesia, and there were streams of clear and apparently pure water that would run in ditches alongside the sidewalk. And this is where people would bathe and do their laundry and get drinking water to cook rice and things like that. So on the way in, I saw groups of people, most of them were women at this particular time, naked from the waist up, bathing in this open, exposed ditch, long ditch with flowing clear water. And they were modest. When we drove by, they kind of covered up, but it was just an initial impression. Huh, what a different culture here. So this next morning, when I got up, I walked along the sidewalk where this ditch was, and I saw all these little houses, and I had my cell phone with me, and I decided to snap some pictures. And I started hearing little voices going, "Good morning! Good morning!" in kind of broken English. They were little kids from, I couldn't see where they were coming from. They must have been in some upper window or some yard behind a wall, but they saw this big white guy sashaying up their street, overwhelmed by this strange environment, and they were welcoming me. And it, as I say so often, blew my mind. I stopped in front of one door and I decided to take a picture of it. The owner happened to be outside. He was just like an ordinary small, I didn't know if he was like a worker there or something. He was the owner of the house or someone who lived there. And he immediately welcomed me. He said, "Please, please take a picture." It was a beautifully hand-carved teak door that entered into this living space. First, he invited me to take the picture. He said, "Let me take your picture." Then he took out his cell phone and took my picture with his cell phone for his possession. Then he brought me in his house and introduced me to his family. And people were there making these offerings with flowers for the gods. This is what you see all over the street. You see it on the sidewalks. You see these little palm leaf boxes filled with flowers, sometimes little coins, sometimes a cigarette or two, on a driveway in the middle of the street, hanging from a tree, everywhere. Some of them are fresh, some of them are old. Nobody gets rid of them, nobody cleans them up. They're offerings to the gods. This is a Hindu country. It's very devotional. And the family was so kind. And they showed me musical instruments. They had some kind of festival coming up. And I realized that the whole family was working on preparing for this festival, making costumes, very elaborate costumes, practicing the traditional instruments. And I spent just a few minutes there. I snapped some pictures and I was just dumbstruck. How could these people invite some complete stranger from an obvious different culture, from the very opposite side of the world, with great lovingness into their houses? And I continued walking down the street, and other people waved at me and said hello and smiled, and it was very, I honestly have to say, it was overwhelming. So, this is a culture, it's rather monolithic. People are mostly on the same, I would say, compared to us, quite low socioeconomic scale. I don't sense that, at least in the neighborhood I was in, there was a lot of comparison between people. There was a sense of community, closeness. Everybody knew everybody. All the houses were extended families. The children all played together. It was a wonderful feeling that folks accepted their situation, accepted each other, and accepted visitors, strangers, into their environment. Because acceptance, kindness, devotion was something that they grew up with. Now, cut to this week and the horrible events, horrible in Orlando, Florida. We live in a culture where there is so much division, so much self-rejection, so much comparison, name-calling, baiting of people because of their race, their belief system, their sexual orientation, all these things that they are, attacking people for what they are. This is the complete opposite of what I experienced walking up that street. The complete opposite. So the end result of this culture of self-criticism, self-judgment, comparison of one's lot to someone else's lot, and the envy and the shame and all the other things that often come of that, or pride, We have mass murders. We have people arming themselves to the teeth with military assault weapons. We have politicians running for the highest office in the land, wanting to bar people because of their religion or some other defining feature from even entering the United States, and attacking whole cultures because of the actions of one or two or a few people. So this is this stark, shocking difference between the culture of a country that's largely quite poor and the culture of a country that is one of the wealthiest in the world. So I wanted to talk tonight about how none of us here in this room, we're Buddhist practitioners, we're Zen practitioners, we've done a lot of Zazen. None of us are immune from the forces that pull away from inclusion, loving kindness, devotion, towards separation, anxiety, strife, hatred. None of us are immune to this. Now, there's nothing automatic in this practice that will make you immune to this. It's very easy for this practice to be turned into an effort to better oneself, to criticize oneself, to set up a pedestal on which you place your teachers, perhaps, or great masters of old, your idea of what it means to be awakened and enlightened, and how you fall short of that, and therefore how you must change because the train's leaving the station and you're still standing on the station. So it's very, very essential in this practice that we start exactly where we are, not at some idealized notion towards which we are moving, scraping along, struggling to get to, as we push away or try to figure out or try to overcome the bad habits of our past. This is not the way to have a healthy relationship to one's Zazen. So in Zazen, it's very important to start precisely where you are, exactly as you are. Start with your precise condition. That includes the fact that you sit down and there are thoughts going on, that something happened that day, that there are feelings and emotions coursing through you, that you may be impatient, you may be bored, you may be depressed, you may be happy, whatever it might be. You start with this, and you let go of the thinking processes that are judging your state in this moment, judging it in any way, that you want it to remain, you want it to go away, you want to fix it through your Zazen, you want to escape it through your Zazen. You start exactly where you are. This is just like my walking down the street and people saying, good morning, and welcoming me, take my picture. It's like that. You do this for yourself. You are the welcomer. You are the good morning little voice from nowhere. You start that way. You observe the sensations of your condition in that moment. As you sit down, this is how we start our Zazen. We don't start in an idealized place. We don't start by struggling against distraction, for example. We start with the actual sensations of where we're at. And then we notice something. We notice something about this, about all these different sensations, all these different conditions, all these different emotions. There's a sameness to them. There's something that runs through them all, runs through each and every one of these states, whether we feel it pleasant or unpleasant. It's their fact. Their fact. Now, I want to read to you from a koan that I have brought up before. I know Norma has talked about this koan. I'm not going to go into the entire koan. I'm just going to read a little part of it as a way to punctuate what I'm saying and kind of point even further into this direction and show you this koan which happens to be the second koan in the Mumon Khan, which is the initial book of 48 koan, the basic primer of Zen, you might say, after passing through the koan Mu, having some measure of awakening, finding out what that you are and what you are, and now moving into a detailed, painstaking examination of how this insight you had melts into the world, merges with the world, how you can go wrong with it, and how you can further it and strengthen it. So this second koan is the very beginning of that process. It's the one Hyakujō and a fox. And you know the story about Hyakujō was a master, he's actually a great master, and he made up a story. This is a made-up story. Let's not engage in magical thinking. About a monk that would always come every day to hear his lectures, and then one day the monk came up to him and confided in him. So the monk remained behind and said to and Hyakujō said to him, "Who may you be?" This is always a test question in Zen. Whenever a Zen master asks you, "Who may you be?" be alert. So the old man replied, "I am not a human being." Now remember, this is not real. This is a story specifically written to point out a critical aspect of our practice. I am not a human being. In the far distant past, in the time of Kashyapa Buddha, which is one of the primordial Buddhas, I was the head of this monastery. On one occasion, a certain monk asked me, and this is the crux of the koan, right here. On one occasion, a certain monk asked me whether an enlightened man could fall again under the chain of cause and effect, and I answered that he could not. Because of this answer, I have for 500 lives been reborn as a fox. I now beg you to release me from this fox body by saying the turning words on my behalf. Please. And then he asked Hyakujō the question that the monk had asked him. Can an enlightened man fall again under the chain of cause and effect or not? Hyakujō answered, "He is not blind to the law of cause and effect." And upon this, the so-called monk, fox, was liberated from his fox body, became a human being. What's this story all about? Let's just focus on this right here. First of all, what is this cause and effect? It brings up cause and effect. Now, at times when we do very deep zazen, we seem to go underneath cause and effect. We go to a place of no color, sound, smell, taste, touch, a focused place of intimacy, centeredness, thoughts settle down. We bring our senses within and we peer into a core place. So this is something that people working on the first koan in this collection, the Mumon Khan, become very adept at doing. This is one of the ways we work on Mu. It's a boring in, a drilling down to a very profound center of awareness. But is that enough? So let's say this person now has some measure of what we might call enlightenment. Is that enough? Where's the risk here? Is there a risk that the wonderful experience of this samadhi state, the purity of it, the depth, the open-hearted, amazing aspect of it that seems to free us from all the things that had burdened us in the past, is this a place to stay? What happens with the world outside this samadhi? How do we deal with it? Now, what do you think happens to people who have this experience? It's very common. What do you think happens? You have this experience of purity, let's say, and I'm including everybody here. We've had periods in our zazen where we're centered, and we get up and we just feel so connected, and all the old neuroses and habit patterns seem to have gone. And maybe we can stay in this state as long as possible. Maybe we can stay in this state permanently. I hope. So, what is the risk here? is that this person now, who has had a very deep experience of this profound peace and joy and liberation from what you might call cause and effect, because they've gone underneath all the differences. They've gone to the no sound, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, thoughts, center of consciousness. When they encounter a cause and effect, what is cause and effect now? You are cause and effect. All your thoughts are cause and effect. All the circumstances in the world are cause and effect. All the circumstances in your life. All your memories. All your habit patterns. Everything. Anything partaking of any particularity, any form, any color, any thought, any sound, any smell. Science tells us this is the world of cause and effect. It's also in Buddhism called dependent origination. Things don't come up alone. It's like the sixth patriarch saying, from the very beginning, not a single thing has ever existed, meaning stood outside this whole fabric of cause and effect. It's a single fabric. So if we cling to this feeling of purity, then the next thing is we feel beset by, opposed by, crushed by the world of cause and effect. And we begin to harden our opinion towards it. We avoid people who aren't spiritual. We avoid situations that aren't spiritual. We beat ourselves up for having thoughts coming back and habit patterns of feeling and reacting that seem so counter to this experience we had, this profound, joyful experience that I hope would last forever. So you can see the risk here. And I can tell you, almost every practitioner, at some point along the way, confronts this issue and often falls into the trap of clinging to Zazen as a way of purifying themselves, making themselves into a better person, avoiding all the mistakes of the past as if somehow they'll go away magically and never come back. So what does Hyakujo say here? So, well, first of all, this monk, he got turned into a fox. Now, what does this mean, he got turned into a fox? A fox is a symbol of a wild animal of rather low repute. So one of the worst fates for someone is to be turned into what's called a wild fox. And they end up getting caught in this cycle of being reborn as a wild fox. So this monk, in answering no, an enlightened person doesn't fall again under the yoke of cause and effect. Well, no. If an enlightened person stubs their toe, does it hurt? If an enlightened person someone coughs in their face, do they get the flu? No, they're not under the yoke. They're not affected by, they're free of cause and effect. Is that what you're saying? So in other words, you've now set up a situation because you are an enlightened teacher that you must be perfect, pure. So how is that different than the guy that killed all those people? How is that different, really, essentially? Essentially. How does that not lead to violence against oneself, self-rejection, judgment of others, pain, despair, depression? This is why it's so important that we start out exactly where we are. When we sit, we start with our condition as it is. We make no attempt to change it, to judge it, to name it. As a matter of fact, we know that's happening, and we don't even judge that process. We simply observe the sensation of that process. As we begin to see that this sensation isn't separate from other sensations, it's a fabric of sensation, and it's all shining in, which is intimate knowing. So it's actually precious to us. Even the things that we hate, even the things that we dislike that cause us pain, as Dogen said, though we hate them, weeds grow. Though we love them, flowers fall. No one is free of this. So we use this as the carrier of this fact, this truth, this Buddha nature. Why reject something that's carrying, that has Buddha nature dissolved in it? This is the issue. So this monk in saying this was actually expressing, showing his trappedness. He was caught in this trap. I'm free of cause and effect. I don't have anything to do with this old self. I'm now this enlightened person. And enlightened people behave this way, and unenlightened people behave that way. And what happens is he's haunted by the self he's pushing away, right? The self he can't be, the self that's not acceptable, is the wild fox that he becomes. Interesting, isn't it? And when the master said, the enlightened person is not blind to cause and effect, he got something profound. What our zazen is unblinding ourselves to cause and effect. This is a core issue in zazen. Unblind yourself from cause and effect. In other words, be mindful of each moment of sensation as it arises. And then, certainly, in order to help your focus, bring the sensation, narrow it down to your breathing, the actual breathing, not some idea of your breathing. So this is unblinding yourself to cause and effect, to the world of form, the world of sensations, this world around us. We unblind ourselves through our awareness, our mindfulness, and our dropping off the thoughts that make one thing good, another thing bad, identify with one thing and disidentify with another. So I'll read one other thing here, which is a wonderful twist to this story. So in the commentary, one of the aspects of kind of just read this one sentence. Mumon says, if in regards to this whole situation that we go into and struggle with in this koan, in regards to this, if you have the one Buddha eye, the one Buddha eye, this awake eye that sees that everything is shining good in nature, you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his 500 lives as a fox. Enjoyed them. Okay, we'll end there today.